Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to the Good Trouble Podcast, where we have curated conversations for racial and economic justice here in the Commonwealth. My name is Reginald Williams. I'm one of your co-hosts here with Mr. Gregory Ball.
Hey, Reggie, how's it going, my friend? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good today, and I'm really excited for this conversation. How are you feeling?
I'm great. I'm excited as well. This is one of the first people that I started to work with when I came on at King Boston. And one of the people who I know is just genuinely committed to getting us into a better place. So I'm actually super excited to talk to her today.
Excellent. Well, we're pleased to announce Dr. Makeba McCrary is here. Makeba, how are you doing?
I'm so good. I really am. So good to be ending the week with both of you in your spirits.
Amen. Well, let's get into it. We're so excited to dig into this conversation. So We know that you're the president of the New Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund, also known as New Commonwealth. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and your background and how you got to where you're at currently?
Sure. I mean, it's a windy path, I tell people often, but I think a necessary one. And the lesson that I hope folks pull out of this is, you know, when it's possible, say yes, you know, take that opportunity. Especially if it's a moment of sort of fear and being uncomfortable, not that pit in your stomach where you know you just should turn around and go in the other direction, not that fear, but the fear of, ooh, I'm very excited about this, but I have no idea how I'm going to actually make it through. So I won't go all the way back, but I will just say that I am. One part of my past that most people don't know is I actually started in theater and I was an actress. I worked in New York for a while. I worked in Boston for a longer while, a lot of stage. And then it slowly turned into commercial work, which I just really didn't dig. And I fell into human service work, which is where my parents were. My parents were both mental health and substance abuse clinicians. And I had my first real job at the Pine Street Inn in the men's unit. And I worked a 3-to-11 shift, put myself through school that way. And a lot of the relationships I still have today really were formed there, both the guests, as we called them, and also my colleagues. Fast forward, I ended up with the blessing of finishing my undergraduate and going to graduate school. And did so only because I really felt like as a Black woman, if I wanted to design any kind of programming, I needed some kind of credential, not because I was like a huge academic wonk. It was not my thing. It was almost my downfall because I also then ended up in a doctoral program. And I didn't end up there. Like I chose to be there. And but the work was so interesting. I was doing a lot of consultation with school districts, urban school districts, around the disproportionate placement of Black and Brown boys into special education classrooms. And that's what I ended up doing my dissertation on 12 years later, a son later, and you know, a pretty solid career under me at that point in time. But I had a chance to say yes to this opportunity. I had a dear friend who called me and she said, I know you're squarely in the philanthropic space, you're squarely in the public education space. She was at Nike and she said, and I have a division here on campus that is giving away a lot of money every year to public schools. And I'm really concerned about the efficacy of their approach and their programming. And she said, I need somebody who knows public education, who knows philanthropy, and frankly is a person of color because they're fairly insular. And it turned out to be Jordan Brand. And they invited me in to redesign their program. And it was, they were giving away $1 million a year. And I remember sitting at the table with Howard, who's the vice president. And I said, I took a chance and I said, you know, not for nothing, but when you give $2,500 to a public school teacher 400 times and you think that's gonna move a needle, you are sorely mistaken. Like that is the equivalent of a welfare model of philanthropy. And you're just not gonna move any needles. You're gonna do good. So, you know, it's very helpful to a teacher to get that extra money. But they hired me. They hired me to continue designing the program and executing the program. And I did that for about 6-8 years, made some other incredible friends that we all hold on to each other across the country still. And I'm getting to the end, sorry. But then I
Take your time.
I ended up again. I got a phone call from the soon-to-be superintendent of Boston Public Schools. I had done a little work helping him think about who he might need to consider in communities of color as he came into Boston. And I'll share the story. I don't typically share this publicly, but I might as well at this point. Because when people ask me, how did you, what was the interview process like? Like, and I just sort of changed the subject. But really what happened was he called me one night and he said, Makiba, look, I thought I was going to bring my entire team from LA. And I've been told by multiple people that I would be really, really, really faulty if I did not have a local chief of staff, somebody who knows Boston. And your name has come up several times. And it was just at a point in time when I felt like I wanted to start to support one brand instead of multiple brands. And I really wanted to have an impact here in my backyard. I was working nationally all over the country. And my son was 8 years old, and it just felt like, oh, this is the time for me to make this investment. I have no idea what a chief of staff really does. I Googled it. If you Google chief of staff, you will only see middle-aged white men. And what you also see is a phenomenon, which is that they are in their positions for about 2.5 years. And then they go on to a much better job afterward. Like, okay. How many of us do you know who we can like do 2.5 year stint and like get level up? And so I thought that was fascinating. I will tell you, after 2.5 years, I distinctly remember my conversation with the mayor where I said, I'm ready to tap out. Like, this is a fire hose. And he was lovely and really supportive and helped me find a way to sort of seg into a new role, and stayed, kept me with the city for a couple more years. I was ready to leave, and I knew that I wanted to continue to make an impact on my city. And I knew that my work needed to be around racial equity also. Like, that was really sort of elevating for me as a priority. And so I picked the place that I thought was the most challenging, would be the most close to people of color, would be the place that we opt out of choosing to be in. And I figured it was either going to be Harvard, right, or the BSO or the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. And so I went to the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. I worked with incredible people, generous, taught me about art history, taught me about museums, I made it through 2.5 years there, a pandemic, a moment of very serious racial reckoning with a middle school that had a horrible experience at the museum. And we came out of the other side, and we won the Best of Boston for going digital with all of our programming, which I was really proud of, but mostly proud of that mural that sits at Madison Park High School called Breathe Life. That ProBlack did while the city was still closed. And we got to be the first public art project to come out of the box. It was aligned with the Jean-Michel Basquiat exhibition that was the second exhibition to open at the museum when we reopened. And really the first nod to celebrating Black artists, Black contemporary artists here in Boston, a tie-in to Jean-Michel and his experience as a Black artist. Not really being recognized at all in the museum sector during his moment. And I sat at the window one day when there was a march or protest happening in relationship to Mr. Floyd's murder. And I remember seeing online a Globe article about 19 Black and Brown C-suite executives who had launched this fund, and they were going to raise $100 million. They were going to invest in Black and Brown people across the Commonwealth and organizations, and they were going to do so to the end of dismantling systemic racism. And I thought, oh my God, I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud. And whatever I can do to be a part of that, I'm going to do it. I had no idea I would end up in this role, but fast forward, again, a yes. I got the email a few times, and I kept thinking, I'm supposed to pay attention to this. Like, I'm not supposed to just keep pushing it to the side. And so here I am, very, very happy.
Well, I know what we're going to call this episode. We're going to call it the most interesting woman in the world. Oh. Because your story, I was fortunate enough to hear you when you shared with us at one of the TBF meetings about kind of all the things that you've gone through and the journey that you've taken. And I wanted to, you know, for you, you've really centered a lot of the work that you're doing in racial equity. What was it about that space? Was it something that sparked in you early on? Was it like, where did that come from? You know, where does, you know, how does little Makiba decide to go that route?
Look, I don't know that I did it intentionally or deliberately, but I would say, Greg, I don't think I had a choice. Mm-hmm. You know, my father is from Mobile, Alabama, a Black man from Mobile, Alabama, moved here when he was 8 or 9 years old. Lived on Forest Street with my mama Jean, who pretty much raised all of us. And my mom is from Ithaca, New York. And she is a very strawberry blonde white woman who comes from a household of highly educated individuals. Mm-hmm. My dad's side of the family, I think I was the first person to get a bachelor's degree. Definitely the first person to go to a graduate program and Harvard, no less. I think that's actually what pushed me through, is I thought Mama Jean would not be okay with me not saying yes to this opportunity. And I share with people that, you know, I have a photograph in my house of my father's side of the family, and it's my Mama Jean, her mother, who was born a slave. Mama Jean, who was born a sharecropper, Aunt May, her daughter, and my Aunt Casey, who was her daughter, my cousin Kipley, who was her daughter. I mean, we are not that far away from a plantation. And that's something that was really resonant at the kitchen table through my childhood. My parents decided to be in love in the 70s in Boston. That was an act of absolute courage. And I didn't realize that on a daily basis, they were walking out of the door facing an incredible amount of violence and potential violence. And I'm in awe when I think about it even today. So we talked about racism. We talked about whiteies. We talked about, you know, honkies and everybody. I mean, it was Malcolm X was, you know, on the wall. The Black Panther movement was probably one of my first book reports. So it started early, Greg.
Okay. So, I mean, it's interesting that you talked, and I know that you talked about your first job was over at Pine Street, right? You know, and how much did that job impact you in your work, in your subsequent work? Like how much was, because I know that was a very important time for you.
It was a different shelter at the time. It's an incredible place now still, but I will say that if you weren't there then and you just have seen it recently, what you wouldn't know is that it was the only wet shelter in the city of Boston, which meant that you could be drinking and drugging and come in no matter what. We also had a park out front where you actually could bring a bottle. Crack cocaine, heroin was still active, but crack cocaine was not quite as prevalent at that point in time. These guys, you know, you on any given night, like you would be doing CPR. You would be making sure that you grab somebody some clean clothes. You would be helping make sure that someone got a haircut. I mean, I honed my hair cutting skills. Those poor men, some of them, they didn't know what hit them, but I got it right. Done.
So wait, I could get a clean fade when I decide right. to get rid of this?
You know, you get them into, you know, a bed. Mm-hmm. You make sure that they wake up in the morning. right. That really, and by the way, a lot of folks who I grew up with, you know, my brother, his siblings, like it was absolutely a there but for the grace of God go I teachable moment. And I met some of the most intelligent, capable individuals in that shelter who taught me so much. I mean, beyond how to kick someone's butt at spades. They taught me really about life and about choices and spirituality and love and parenthood. So yeah, that was a formative, you know, 8 or 9 years for me.
Yeah, it seemed like the work that you've done and that you've shared with us is really like you had almost like the front seat. You're at the front seat to view people's humanity, because even in your work as an actress, you know, there's a piece of you that has to tap into like the person. You like you have to go into some different spaces in your mind. Like I wonder just how much that you know, how much of that you even bring into the world of your work now, that your life and drama.
Yeah, so you know, the principles that we were taught in studio at Circle in the Square in particular were about being present, the practice of listening, like listening to somebody. And I think like I often remember the mantra, is it something you want or is it something you need? Because they are very different things. And the way you go after something you want and the way you go after something you need really does show up differently. I think the last thing is understanding that everybody walks into the room looking for how, like what their path is out, right? And if you're in their way, or if you're holding their arm and walking with them, or if you're sort of pushing them out of the, you know, the scope, the line of sight, those are all interactions that you have to be accountable for. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, I think of that often, like we are all moving through space together. And when we cross paths, it can be incredibly beautiful. It can be, you know, caustic, or it can be just passive. But paying attention to that and respecting other people and what they have brought into that room, I think is another lesson that I carry forward.
I really appreciate that, Makeep, especially as you talk about your history and your family's history in terms of, you know, going from being like close to the generation of folks who were enslaved to sharecropping to like where you stand today. And, you know, just thinking about all the ways in which you've blazed trails in almost every space that you've stepped in your life, you know, like looking at being the first, you know, chief of learning and community engagement at the MFA, the first president appointed for the new Commonwealth Fund. I'm curious, you know, as on the heels of, you know, this historic confirmation of Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court, what is it like to be the first? What is it like to really have to set that path ablaze and to continue leaning into that? I know you mentioned also showing up with empathy and looking for that pathway in and out. So I'm curious what that experience has been like for you looking back on it.
I would first like to say that I really need our country to stop allowing particularly Black women to be subjected to the kind of treatment that the justice had to endure to receive the honor that she had well earned. And the fact that we allowed her treatment to be publicized for days on end is to me really problematic. So I just want to put that out there, because that's what happens when you're the first, is you look around and you're like, where is everybody? what happened? Like I had my, where are my boys at? Where are my girls at? You know? And that's not to say that I would not acknowledge I've had incredible amounts of support, but it does, it's not the same as folks standing right there next to you. And I don't actually suggest it for too many people, certainly not for the faint of heart. It's not even necessary, I think, to always step out and be the first. I don't regret being the first at the museum, but I will say that I really believe in the Noah's Ark version of like two at a time. At least two at a time, I mean, you know, one person can only sing so loudly, and then they lose their voice.
Well, then that leads me to the question, because from the whole idea of being first, you know, when I also listen to you talk about your journey, you've had a lot of work where, I guess for lack of a better term, is just very, very heavy. How do you, you know, and that you're, you know, if you're interacting with people, you know, at work all day, and you're dealing with very, very serious and grave issues, how do you balance that part of it? Because I would imagine that's a piece of being first, is like, you know, who do you talk to when things get tough? And, you know, how do you make sure you're present for your family, you know, and balancing those things? Has that been a challenge for you as well?
I have, so self-care has been a challenge for sure, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's, I think, always a juggling act. And before we got on here, I just, you know, I announced that I'm 50 now. So I have a whole new perspective on what I'm allowed to do. And I am taking much more advantage of those things around self-care in particular. But I will say that I don't have a lot of friends. I have a couple of folks that got me through the museum, 100%. I have a couple mm-hmm. of folks that got me through the city, 100%. And I'm just blessed, right? I would say, like, if I were offering advice to somebody who is putting themselves into a role where they are gonna deal with heavy stuff and potentially on their own most of the time, that it's really critical to find the people that you trust, that you can download to. You gotta get it out. Like, that toxicity will absolutely fester if you hold it. And so I'm a firm believer in, you know, things like yoga, things like, you know, I used to run a lot. I can't run anymore, but you know, whatever you can do to release that stuff. I've seen a lot of people who didn't figure that out. And I mean, you can just see them carrying all of that stuff in their bodies, in their health, in their mindset. And it's not necessary.
It's really powerful. You know, self-care is a part of the work. You know, rest does resistance, especially given everything going on. And I know that you mentioned the work of New Commonwealth really spurring out of this racial reckoning around the murder of Mr. George Floyd. Can you talk a little bit about how New Commonwealth Fund's work is really working to address that holistically through your philanthropic efforts and making sure that nonprofit organizations and community members have the resources that they need to really thrive?
Sure. I mean, what these folks, they all are in corporate entities, and they said, listen, CSR strategy, nice to have. That's not what this is. And it's not about you, corporation A or B or C. It's actually about me. As a leader of color, I have a responsibility, and I'm accountable to figuring this out. And we haven't, as a corporation, figured it out. And we haven't, as a city, figured it out. And so I'm going to take my best shot. And you're going to put some money into this, right? Like, you're going to write a check. That's all we need. We need you to write a check. Because the folks who are doing this work, they actually know how to do the work. We don't even need to tell them how to do the work. We just need to resource them. And Black and Brown leaders philanthropically have received, you know, like 98% less resources than white organizations.
98?
I mean, it's pretty tragic. And
wow.
That's a, you know, I think that's a national statistic, but I imagine that we are a microcosm of that. I'd have to go pull the stats for Massachusetts. I'm sure I have them. Equally fragile and, you know, disheartening. Mm-hmm. So they did two rounds of grants before I joined to 59 organizations across the Commonwealth. And when I came on board, we were still sort of shut down. So I had to Zoom with people. I couldn't do site visits. Man, I was so impressed. And I thought I knew organizations, right? I'm strong in Boston. I'm strong in some of the surrounding towns, but like stuff that's happening in Worcester and Lawrence and Chelsea, Cambridge even, I was just blown away by the authenticity of these leaders, by their commitment, by the shoestring they were working on, by the joy that they were presenting their work in the middle of this craziness, still out there getting kids together, touching families, turning their organizations into soup kitchens, into job placement, into childcare, into housing, you know, doing what they had to do to take care of their community. So we're moving forward with the same set of principles that we are here to support Black and Brown leaders that are leading nonprofits, small, medium, large. But we do have 5 pillars of focus. The first 4 are consistent with where they started, which is policing and criminal justice reform, health equity, economic empowerment, and youth development. We've since added a 5th. Which we'll do more of a sort of loud announcement about, but I'll preview it here. I'm very excited about it, which is this idea for me, it comes from 2 places. One, spending 2.5 years at a museum where I got to see people like Harriet Powers, and a quilt that she created that just told the story of legacy, or Bisa Butler, right, who has crafted these incredibly massive portraits of young Black and Brown men and families, as an example, or Dave the Potter, who is actually was inscribing. He was a slave. He knew how to write, and he was inscribing poems that were a little snarky to sort of push back at the owners. But the owner was selling his work and making a lot of money. To Mr. Floyd being murdered, and all the images that you see, not just Mr. Floyd, but a lot of us murdered by law enforcement with impunity. If you Google Black man in America, right, like how many images of a Black man being arrested do you find? And if that's what our babies are seeing on a daily basis, or they're watching the news and they're seeing only stories of negativity and not seeing positive imagery of women of color taking leadership roles. That's who they think that they are going to be. Like that's their potential future. That they see it, they believe it. Like let's let them see something and believe something different. Like that mural I was referencing that Pro-Black did at Madison Park High School, that is a 30-foot tall little brown girl who I watched other little brown girls walk by all summer and look up and say, oh my God, that's me, right? Like that's what you need. And so we will be launching a new pillar, which is called Identity and Culture Narrative. And you can wrap that in whatever way you think it makes sense, but like, let's just tell our own stories.
Yes.
And let's tell the truth about our stories and who we are.
It's not lost on me that identity and culture narrative is so important from the work that I feel like all of us here have done historically in our communities around making sure that we have access to the conversation, making sure that we have access to the amplification of the conversation, and that we're really closing those feedback loops with community. You know, you supported the work that I did in media literacy way back in the day, and it's like, how do we make sure that we are unpacking what you're seeing about yourself from someone else's gaze, from someone else's investment, is actively shaping your reality and ultimately your destiny. Like, how do you counter that? By being the change, you know? And I think what you said around some of the tapestry and the quilts in the physical museum is really important, as we're also working to transform these longstanding institutions to be more inclusive of artists from our communities who have had the ability to stay here because we've made investments in them and making sure that they're seen and heard. That's really exciting, Makiva.
Thank you.
That's a lot.
I was going to say, go ahead, Reggie.
Well, this is called Good Trouble, right?
Yes, it is. That is the plan. That is the name of the podcast, is to talk about that good trouble that folks like you are getting into.
Yes. So thinking about, I'd love to kind of circle back on creative placemaking and placekeeping, really, especially given all of the investment that's going on in Boston. We're seeing, you know, new, you know, I know that they just broke ground in Nubian Square for the Benjamin Franklin Institute of Technology to, you know, move from the South End over to Roxbury. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on how physical space and access, especially given that we're now in more of a hybrid, maybe a remote first environment coming out, getting to a more endemic stage of COVID-19, how can we make investments to make sure that we have access to space in Roxbury and Mattapan and Hyde Park? You know, there's so much space out there, and we see a lot of these venues have kind of shuttered as really caused by the pandemic, but also they were historically underfunded long before the pandemic. How do we get back out there? How do we keep folks in our communities?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. The first is I had the pleasure last night of being on a panel with Chief Shagun. I'm going to say his last
name. Yeah.
And he has some really exciting things that he's taking on. So if you haven't had him on the show yet, have him on the show. I have a lot of faith in his will to get it done. And then I think the second thing is I am really interested in what it means to sort of like sink massive amounts of energy and investment, not just dollars, but like focus into geographical spaces. And so I'm curious about how a new Commonwealth Fund might partner with a few other philanthropies to invest in the Blue Hill Lab corridor. Right, like how do we and do so by identifying multiple organizations to come together on a strategy. Doesn't mean they walk away from their own work. It just means that they synergize around solving like-minded challenges that they're experiencing. Same with Nubian Square. So we're thinking about how we can influence on both sides. But I think it's, you know, my son's a huge introvert and I'm not too far from him. But I do enjoy people, right? So I'm looking forward to the ability to sort of still have opportunities to be shoulder to shoulder with somebody, not all the time, but every now and then. Whereas, you know, there are some folks that really will now benefit from access not because they're introverts, because they just may not have the bandwidth or the lifestyle to be able to physically be present somewhere. And now they can, you know, now they can actually zoom into something and be, you know, a part of a community. And so I have to say we should probably embrace what we've learned about, you know, this hybrid option as much as it exhausts me to try to live in both worlds. I think it's opened up some real opportunity for equity and access.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Oh, go ahead, Reggie. Go ahead.
You got it.
I was gonna say I agree with you. I have faith in Chief Idowu as well, and that whole idea of organizations working together to focus in one area, I think, is very important. I think that, you know, the problem I see many times is that we have organizations that are all kind of going in the same directions, but there are different spaces of that same work. And I think the idea of people coming together to take care of the, you know, their piece of that puzzle, I think just makes sense. And it's the kind of next level thing that I think we need to start doing, particularly if we want to transform our neighborhoods, but right here in Boston and throughout the Commonwealth. And for you, you're part of a wave of folks that has kind of stepped into leadership roles over the past couple of years. Do you think that do you think you're in the right place at the right time in terms of that class? I mean, I guess the class of people who are in these spaces. I'm thinking about Eric Estevez over at Zakim Fund and Lisa Owens and, you know, Imari Paris Jeffries over at King Boston and Marie Frances Rivera over at Mass Budget. I think that you're part of a wave that's kind of been a change. Do you think that it's the right time for all of you all to be working together?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's so lifting and there's so much light in it. I can't tell you. I talked earlier about sort of standing there being the only one and like looking side to side and saying, mm-hmm. like, and we get a chance to look side to side and see each other. It's really like, it feels like a bit of a fairy tale, right? Why me? Why now? But I'll take it. It's really fantastic. And I think that there's an opportunity for similar trends to take place in other sectors as well.
And, you know, it's one other thing that I thought that you're probably uniquely positioned to answer is, you know, we talk about that cultural representation and the importance of the arts. You know, what about the business of the arts? I believe that, you know, culture is kind of the lifeblood of the city, and it's essential to kind of transforming neighborhoods. You know, what is it that we can do to help create more space for working artists? You know, I went to Nashville recently, and you know, you can be a guitarist in Nashville, and you don't have to put out a hit record, but you can feed yourself every day. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because, and what is it that we can do in Boston to kind of create that space for artists here? What do you think about, you know, what do you think are some things that we could do?
Look, shameless plug, but this is a perfect entree, which is Cerdna Foundation has a part of their work that's called Thriving Cultures, led by Javier Torres, who used to be here in Boston. He's at the Boston Foundation, but he's leading this incredible transformative work around bringing racial justice and equity to arts and culture. And he is supporting Natanya Craig Okwendo, who's the president or executive director of the Boston Women's Fund, and I, to co-lead a coalition of Black and Brown artists that we've started to call together. I should tap you, Greg, to think about who else could be in the room. But
absolutely, I got you back.
We had one meeting and it was so incredible. I mean, literally, I've had folks like call me, text me afterwards and say, like, I've never had that conversation before. And here's what we said. We said, listen, and Natanya and I are making a commitment to listening to you tell us what you need. Like, what is missing for you? And then our job is to figure out how to get the other philanthropic entities from the city at the table who say they do arts and culture funding and support their learning around how they need to redirect those dollars, both to the BIPOC artist community and creative community, but also to the things that you just said you need, not the initiatives that they're interested in seeing come to life. And I'll, you know, bottom line, space, right? Like, folks need studio space that they can afford. We need a gallery. We need a gallery that does not, you know, take 50% of the artist proceeds out of their pocket. That's my own personal soapbox. Mm-hmm. We need, these are things they said to us. Like, I'm not Makiba saying it. This is, you know, Equa Holmes and Shaomba Dibinga and Rob Gibbs and McLena Gomes. These folks are saying, Liza Quinones, very fundamentally, we need an investment in the resources that the city has plenty of. We just need in, right? We need to be prioritized. So I'm excited about that conversation. Like, invite me back for that conversation, because we purport to be this incredibly supportive community for arts and culture in the city of Boston. And yet, once again, you know, Black and Brown folks are being locked out of those, that being able to be, to prosper, to have economic empowerment, to your point, to like pay their bills and eat every day and not have to work a 9-to-5 and figure out how they're going to squeeze in enough time in the studio, if they have one, mm-hmm. to produce something that makes them joyful.
It's not lost on me that everyone enjoys the fruits of the labor of arts and culture. You know, everyone likes the new music that drops on Friday, or seeing the beautiful mural when it's like, what do our communities actually look like? And we have, you know, these electric generators that are turned into public art installations, and, you know, taking over space in a positive way, but people don't want to make the investment. You know, it's like, you can't expect the fruits without actually planting the seed. And we're really glad to have partners like you and others in philanthropy working to make those investments real. Also, something you said, Makiba, that really stuck out for me was, having access to the conversation. And I just think so much about how the pandemic really transformed access to folks being able to Zoom in for these parent-teacher conferences, or maybe, you know, like a joint committee on education hearing where they wouldn't have been able to go to the State House physically. I'm curious, how can we get more folks involved in the civic debate as well? I feel like just with all the information that's out there, there are so many opportunities where folks are soliciting community input, particularly now around how to spend these federal COVID program dollars, like through the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, and others. But folks don't know enough about it to weigh in meaningfully on most occasions or some occasions. I'm curious to get your thoughts on how we can strengthen the conversation in community.
That's a great question. My answer may be a little pessimistic, but you know, here's the thing. I think folks need to actually believe that their input's gonna matter. Mm. So it's the chicken and the egg, right? Like, how do you get somebody at the table if they don't feel like what their voice is going to be heard? And I think one of the ways you do that is, I think you have to tell the truth. You have to acknowledge that there's a reason they feel that way. Like, it just didn't manifest itself out of, like, you know, fairy dust. It's because they've come to the table multiple times. They've said how they're feeling, what they need, what they're looking for, what their children and family needs are. And they've been disregarded time and time again, but they've seen other parts of our city be highly regarded. And so that, you know, breeds distrust and I think, you know, apathy, right, to some degree, which we've seen in our elections. And so how do you reverse that? You know, I think it's a slow grind. I think we really need to go back to thinking about how community organizing efforts are really important. The door-to-door, you know, if I had my way, honestly, I would love to see a world in which candidates could not spend more than, I know somebody's going to send me hate mail, but like $5,000 on a campaign for marketing, period, hard stop. Get your butt out and door knock, go meet people. Like, that's the sweat equity that doesn't happen when, you know, you spend gajillions of dollars on ads. But well, now we're in this perpetual spin where, like, the only way you actually can get somebody who's valuable into an elected office is if you can raise enough money to make sure that they show up, you know, in media, because that's what's driving the polls, and polls are driving belief systems. It's crazy. But and I've supported candidates, and I've, you know, worked on PACs. Like, I've been in the midst of the dark matter. But I mean, I think, Reggie, that, like, that's a place where there are organizations that are, again, like, under-resourced, but doing the work that we actually need to amplify so that, you know, the folks down the corner and up the street and, you know, somebody shows up in their backyard and says, can I get 5 minutes to just tell you who's on the ballot?
Right.
That's what I think.
Okay. I really appreciate that take, especially given that we're in election season here in the Commonwealth, you know, seeing how folks are really put, you know, the algorithms and everything around how we are accessing information right now is monetized. And most of us know that. But when you're looking at where these interests are really driving the dollars, it's like, are we looking to make a progressive future for the Commonwealth or for our nation? Or are we just looking to make sure that we have access to, you know, to be on the throne? Mm-hmm. We can have that whole other conversation on a separate episode. I'd love to get a sense, thinking about philanthropy, and, you know, we've talked a little bit about investing in communities and getting the resources that folks really need to thrive and to stay in their communities. I'm curious to get your thoughts on how we can also transform local philanthropy, you know, so in terms of, like, giving circles and making sure that folks have access to tapping into the resources within our communities. I know some folks like the Boston Ojima Project are really good at, have done raises around how to make sure that investors have a say in where their dollars are going, much like with the state budget from a mass budget perspective or other policies. I'm curious just to get your thoughts on how we can make sure that folks know that we can be the change and we can be the bank too if we come together.
And well, look, for a new Commonwealth Fund, here's what my strategy is. I believe that there's incredible amounts of individual wealth in this city that we should be taking advantage of inviting into this work. I think there's corporations that made some fairly empty pledges at an opportune moment in time, and they should be called to task and be given an opportunity to fulfill those pledges. And I also think that my mom and dad should be able to write a check for $100 to the end of dismantling systemic racism. Super excited to be working with Bethia Carter and New England Blacks in Philanthropy to build giving circles across the Commonwealth. And, you know, our model, we're going to do a little spin on it, which is, you know, Reggie, you get 9 of your friends together, call together $1,000 each, and we'll match that $1,000 up to $10,000. And then we will give you a list of the nonprofits either in the pillar area that you're interested in or the geographic space that you're interested in. And you can refund those organizations. You can contribute to dismantling systemic racism, right? My son can hit a button on an app and we can gamify dismantling systemic racism, but you know, he might only be able to do $5. Everybody has to be a part of this work. It's not a Black person problem. It's not a brown person problem. It's all of our problems. We are the canary in the mine, but you better believe that, like, if we don't solve it for us, there's somebody right around the corner who's, you know, next in line. If not already, right? I think we've actually seen the already. I think we have witnessed this. So I think we have to double check our humanity, A, and then B, I think there has to be as many entry points into investing in solving for this. And by the way, the solutions are out there already, right? Like, don't worry. We already know what the work is that has to happen. We just need to make sure that it can be sustained and amplified as appropriate and for the long run.
Now the long haul is, you know, I really appreciated what you said around everyone having an opportunity to come in and make a contribution towards solving these challenges, whether it's $1, $10, $100, $1,000, $1 million, everyone has access to being the part of the solution if they're interested. And I think it's also back to that conversation around trust in government and the stigma associated with it. Folks want, like, need to be able to believe that their money and their resources, their time or their talent, if they're volunteering, could also support us in really closing these gaps. And I feel like the space that we've been in has been quite down, quite negative, because we came out of a long 5 to 10 year stretch of a lot nationally, locally, across the state. So as we're looking to get to that other side, as we're looking to get to the future, you know, we have to remind ourselves that with empathy for ourselves, like noting that we've been through a lot, we can get to the other side if we truly believe in it.
Amen.
Well, wow. And just like that, our time has sped by. We have to wrap this whole party up.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a good way to spend a lunch hour on a Friday.
Listen, we appreciate it. It was a lot of negotiation getting you know, your hot ticket. You're hot in the streets. You're hot in the streets. You know what I'm saying?
I'm building a plane, that's all. I'm just building a plane.
Yes. No, but we absolutely appreciate you taking the time out and sharing with us. You know, I think that I feel like you have like an inspirational story that every time I hear from you or talk to you, so there's another piece that you find out about Makeba that just makes you like, wow, she can do that too. Like, you know what I mean? She just has all these wonderful dimensions that she's sharing with us and leading the way. And we thank you for joining us today. So Reggie.
Well, folks, that's all the time that we have today. We'll catch you next time on the Good Trouble Podcast. Makeba, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.